Welcome to Advancing Advocacy for this September term. I'm Brenda Jones, and I have Larry Neely with me from New Mexico, who's going to be our primary speaker for the evening. And we're going to be talking about advocating in the smaller state legislatures, which is the majority of states around the country. Larry has been working as a lobbyist and citizen advocate for many years and has had some success even in our issues, but he goes back in terms of his experience way before getting involved in this issue. So he's got a lot of good information to share with us, and I hope most of you have been able to also be looking at our PowerPoint, which we have available if you have installed the software so that you can watch. We'll go along, but Larry will try to cover the things out loud as well, just in case you're just listening in. So, Larry, without further ado, I'd like to hand it over to you to say hey and let us know what you have to share.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Brenda. And talking is what I do best. So
yay.
I'm right at home here. Hope everybody can hear me. So we're going to be talking about advocating. I don't like to use the term, don't prefer the term lobbying, but that has connotations that I don't like in terms of what some have, states require registering for a lobbyist. But we had this presentation last month, which was a fantastic presentation from Janice Bellucci, but it didn't really cover advocacy and part-time legislatures the way that it that I felt it should be covered, because part-time citizen legislatures operate nothing like full large legislatures that have year-round operations and have staff. So we're going to be concentrating tonight on the smaller legislatures and the part-time citizen legislatures where most of you guys live, and some large states still have part-time legislatures, even Texas. So as you see on your screen, for you, those of you that you're watching, I feel that what's really important is building relationships with lawmakers, understanding the legislative process, and knowing how to work committee hearings. Committee hearings is where it really all happens. So as we, if I can figure out how to change the page here without going too many. Citizen legislatures are quite different than a state like California. The sessions are shorter. Lawmakers work regular jobs to support their families. And lawmakers have very small staffs, if any. In some instances, they have no personal staff at all provided by the state. And some states, they don't even have offices in their Capitol buildings, which is a surprise to me because we at least have that in my state of New Mexico. And they don't have experts to perform research for them. And I remember from the presentation from Janice about California, there were so many times where Janice says, well, you just need to find the policy person that handles this issue. Well, in a small state, there is no policy person that handles that issue. So those are some of the differences that you have in a citizen legislature versus a professional full-time legislature in California, like in California and other states. So don't want to go too fast, but we got a lot of territory to cover. So there's some other differences. The financial ramifications of legislation in a citizen legislature sometimes is not readily apparent. It's easy to propose. It's easy for a lawmaker to introduce a bill. But sometimes the ramifications are not readily apparent. I remember just a few years ago, I'm going to pick on Arkansas, a lawmaker there said, well, I'm going to put a requirement that everybody who's a certain level of sex offender, when they get out of prison, that they have GPS monitoring and some for the rest of their life. And the question came up, well, how much is it going to cost? And she said, I don't know, but it's going to be many years before, because it's prospective application anyway, so everybody has to work their way through the system. So we don't know. We really don't care. We need to get it on the books. But in a citizen legislature, guess who the experts are? The experts are the lobbyists. the people who come and advocate for legislation that's pending or against legislation that's pending. That's who often become who is the expert. And many of you on this telephone call tonight could very well become an expert with a little bit of study, actually quite a lot of study, but you could become an expert yourself, and you could be helpful in the legislative process. So I added this slide here. This is a presentation that Brenda has done for us and presented at various venues, and I plagiarized it and tweaked it, and so hopefully I haven't gotten it too butchered. But many of you want to know, how is a legislative proposal, how is a bill born? And we're going to talk about that a little bit, because in a citizen legislature, these representatives and senators, they don't sit around and burn the midnight oil and think up all this stuff on their own and draft these proposals. Anything that pertains to our issue that we're talking about tonight, which is the sex offender registry or crimes and punishment related to sexual offenses, The driving forces behind that type of legislation comes from your state district attorneys association, your association of police chiefs, your sheriff's association in your state, and from victim advocate organizations. They have the proposal, and they come to a lawmaker, and there's one more bullet that's not on this slide, and that's from the state agencies themselves. They feel they need legislation. They need something changed. So like with the sex offender registry, in most states, the State Department of Public Safety or its equivalent, the state police or some engine of state government will approach a lawmaker with a proposal and say, here's what we need to do. Here's the proposal. We need to update our registration to comply with the Adam Walsh Act, or we need to close loopholes that we've discovered because the sex offenders are taking advantage of X, Y, and Z. And the lawmaker says, yes, Mr. Agency Head, or yes, Mr. District Attorney Association, yes, Mr. Chief of Police, I will carry that piece of legislation for you. They simply take that piece of legislation, that proposal that the agency or the organization has drafted, they take it to their bill drafting service in their legislature. We call that, in New Mexico, we call that the Legislative Council Service. In Maryland, they call it Legislative Services, and they have different names of it, but there's an entity that works in some capacity for each state legislature, and they draft that into a proposal form, put a bunch of numbers on it, and the lawmaker signs their name, take it to the chief clerk, and they say, I'm introducing this legislation, and it gets read, introduced on the floor. If it's a House member or a House of Delegates or a representative, it's given a House bill number. If it's a senator that introduces it, it's given a Senate bill number. And that's how a proposal is born. But it wasn't born because some lawmaker spent his night over the midnight oil thinking it up. It was because it was presented to him or her, and they were asked to carry it, and they agreed to do it. So that's how legislation is born. And I'm going backwards, not forward here, so it's turning the page. So the bill gets introduced, as I just described, by a lawmaker. And in most instances, you cannot introduce a bill yourself. I've heard some states where there's some process by which an individual can get a bill introduced. But as a general rule, from my experience and advocating in a number of states around the country, it must be introduced by a person who's elected to the body. So now you can ask a lawmaker as a citizen to introduce a proposal for you, and he or she might do that. But what a lot of us make mistakes that we make when we want a proposal introduced is we talk about the concept to the lawmaker, and we don't actually give them the language of what we want. And conceptually, when you have a conversation with a lawmaker, you say, well, you know, it ought to be against the law to X, Y, Z. And they go, yeah, I agree with you. That sounds pretty good. But you have to reduce it to writing for them. And You may not have to have it in proposal form exactly like it's going to appear when the bill drafting service drafts it, but you have to have your concept down on paper. And once you have that in a proposal form where you can show what your legislation might do, then he or she was going to be more willing to talk about, yes, I'll carry that for you. And that will increase the likelihood of your proposal actually securing a sponsor. And I think Brenda might have some experience on this. As we've worked together in Maryland, we had the desire to introduce a proposal about worship in Maryland and the difficulty of finding a sponsor. Did you want to comment on that before we move to the next slide, Brenda?
It was challenging. You can hear me okay. Yeah, you can hear me okay, right? Yeah. Because we found somebody that was willing to sponsor, but the other thing I think, and maybe you're going to hit this in the next slide, was that, yeah, she definitely preferred to have something written to say, okay, it's going to go in this piece of the law, and, you know, and here's our proposed wording, and she could change it, and did. But we had to have it written down. But then the other challenging thing, you know, the other thing she said was, and you're going to move this through you're going to go around and help me find sponsors and help me find other people for this, right? You're going to move this through. We said. So they also are kind of, a lot of times they're going to want you to help make it happen once it's introduced too, so. Yeah,
that's a very good point that I don't have in the next slide.
Oh, okay.
But it's a very good point to add. When you're dealing with lawmakers, the assemblies, except for New Hampshire, if I don't know if New Hampshire is on here tonight, but the assemblies are very small by and large across the country. Ours has 112 members. California has 120 members. So you can see that a California lawmaker represents a whole lot more people than a New Mexico lawmaker does. Nebraska has 49, and I don't remember the total in Maryland, but usually they're in the 100 to 100 to 150 range of lawmakers. And in our legislature, out of our 112 lawmakers, there's usually 1,600 to 2,000 bills introduced. So when they introduce a bill, it has a lot of territory to cover. And they need your help. Remember, it's your battle, not theirs. So when you go with something you want done, they are expecting you to do a lot of the work that we'll talk about later about how it works its way through the process. But that should have been a slide to itself here. So this next piece is a compliment to Brenda of how the legislative process works and. A little flow chart of introducing the bill and the drafting part, and then the introducing in the House or the Senate, and then it's assigned to committees. And I'm going to talk more about New Mexico committee process, but your committee process in your state is going to differ somewhat, and you're going to need to learn it. I can't stress that enough. You're going to need to find out what committees typically your legislation is going to be assigned to. In our state, a bill that's introduced is going to be assigned to two committees in each chamber of the legislature, and that's the minimum. It could be getting more, but it's going to be assigned to two committees. So a House bill is introduced into the House. After the clerk reads it, after the speaker says, I'm assigning it to the Judiciary Committee and to the Public Affairs Committee, if it manages to make it through those two committees and get to the floor for a vote and pass the House, it's going to be introduced. The legislation is going to be taken across the rotunda and introduced into the Senate, and it's going to get the same thing. After the clerk reads the title and they read it by title and a little bit about what the legislation is going to do, the president pro tem of the Senate is going to do the same thing. He's going to assign it to two committees, and it's going to repeat that process. So, and if it doesn't pass, if it does not pass the same way it came out of the House, it's got to go back to the House for concurrence, if that's where the bill started, And if they cannot concur, then there's a more complicated process of going to conference committees. But you can see on this flow chart, in Maryland and some of the states I've worked in, they assign the bills to just one committee, which typically for Maryland, I noticed, is in the House is Judiciary, and if it's a Senate bill, it's a committee called Judicial Proceedings. And in Nebraska, the only state in the country that has only has a unicameral legislature, so they don't have a House and a Senate. They just have one chamber. I noticed that they run the stuff through the Judiciary Committee over there. So, but in that Nebraska unicameral, it's going to go through that committee process, however many committees it's assigned to, and then go to the floor for a vote if it makes it through committee. But your committees are so important because that's where the public comment comes in. That's where the limited analysis takes place of the legislation. And that's where the amendments are going to take place to make it better. And that's where the power broker determines if it gets heard, which is the committee chair, when it gets heard. And if you have an ally in the committee chair, that committee chair may cause the scheduling to be difficult to get a crappy bill heard. He or she may delay that thing for some time. If you have that kind of relationship with the committee chair, which I do in some instances here in the state, and since our legislature, our House flipped parties, I don't have that quite as much relationship as I once did, but you go to those committee chairs and say, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, this House Bill 240 is a piece of shit. Here's why. And if that committee chair trusts you that you're given good information and that it is crappy and why, rather than putting it on next week's schedule, that bill may get scheduled 3 weeks out. And when you're running a short session of 60 days, if you can delay something, delaying it is killing it, because it's got a lot of territory to cover and a short time to cover it in. And in Maryland, I know that Brenda may want to comment on this, they don't have quite the relationships that we have, but they've been building their relationships, and they kind of know how to work the committee process there as well, and how mm-hmm. vital that is to knowing what the committee's chairs can do for you.
Right, definitely a similar situation here. One of the things, the powers that our committee chairs have, so it's really helpful to know them, is that they can basically circular file a bill. They can tuck it into a drawer and never call it up for a vote. Larry was quite shocked, I think, to find out that we, not necessarily that they had that authority, but because in his, that bill goes up for a vote immediately after the hearing. In ours, it's scheduled for a different time, and if the chair never calls it up for a vote, well, it just dies. It just withers on the vine, and that's done somewhat behind the scene. So, so if you've convinced the committee chair that this is a bad piece of legislation, they have to take testimony. But afterward, they can just deep six it, and you never hear from it again. So they hold a lot of power, and we've been really blessed to have a good friend in one of the chambers, and decent enough connections in the other, but definitely one that's been very good in one chamber. So
I'm going to expand a little bit on your point there, because I think the novice would not get what you're saying.
Okay.
When a bill is in committee and they're taking public testimony, and then in our state, they move directly to debate on the legislation after they've heard all the public testimony that they're going to hear. Sometimes they have to limit it because of the number. Sometimes they hear from everyone, and then they go into the members to begin to debate. Well, in her state, they don't do it that way. They take their public testimony, and they go through their list of stuff, and then they have debate later. And then they may not ever vote. Here, at the end of public testimony, they will proceed to debate if the bill is worthy of debate. The public testimony may have been so compelling that the first member, when they open for debate, may make a motion to table. But if it doesn't get tabled and killed right then, here debate will take place, and they will take a vote to give that legislation do pass or do not pass. And you know, at the end of that of that committee meeting, what that legislation is going to continue moving, or if it died. In her state, you have to watch the calendar. You have to come and hang out at 2 o'clock in the morning when they meet, whatever they meet, at some undisclosed location to figure out what they're going to do when they finally post it on the website. And they may not have done anything at all. It may have just been allowed to die because they decided it was crappy legislation. But here, at the end of the discussion, at the end of the public testimony, there will be a vote, one way or the other, to table it or move it on. So yeah. I hope that helps people. Mm-hmm. So.
And remember, folks, those of you who are just listening, the PowerPoint is visible if you've gone to if you've managed to download the Start Meeting software that you got. But if you're missing it and you don't want to fool with it right now, we are recording, and when you go back to watch the recording later, you would be able to see it then. So. Okay.
So the next slide is we're gonna harp about relationships. You're gonna hear that until you're blue in the face tonight. Relationships are critical to your success. You've got to know who your state senator and your state representative or your state delegate is. And I'm not talking about the people in Washington, D.C. I asked somebody the other day, who's your senator? Oh, it's Mikulski. And I said, no, she represents you in D.C. So when we're talking about our issues, we're talking about primarily in your state capital. We could do a whole other session about the federal level, but if the Adam Walsh Act were to be repealed tomorrow, nothing would change in your state. Your registry would still be working the way it is. Your laws for punishment would still be working the way they are today, and everything would be the same. But in your relationship, you need to know who your senator and who your representative is. Once you figure that out, you may find out that they cannot help you because they're not assigned to a committee that's going to be helpful, because their committee may not be assigned any of our legislation. They may not serve on judiciary or your equivalent committee that handles that. Remember, I gave you the assignment to figure out how many committees typically our type of legislation goes through in your state. But you need to figure out if your senator or representative serves on any of the committees that hear our type of legislation. In our state, we need to keep track of four committees because it's going to get at least four, and it's typically the same four. So you need to know if your person serves on those committees, and if not, you need to start figuring out who does serve on those committees and what kind of relationships you can form with them. The most important one, of course, is the chair. But every member has an equal vote. The chair has the power to decide if something gets a hearing. But when it gets down to voting, all votes are equal. So you want to have relationships with people on those committees. Part-time legislators, they're very accessible. Believe it or not, they really are. A lot of them have their phone numbers on their state legislative website that you can call them at. They have emails that it may be a state email address, but they do review those emails. So I was going to ask for a virtual show of hands who knows who their state senator or their state representative is, but we won't spend the time on that. But it's important that you know that information. And if they can't help you, then you need to form relationships with people who can. And, of course, when it comes to a floor vote, they will be able to vote on the legislation if it gets out of committee and gets to the floor. So the next slide is a little bit further of what we're talking about, the right relationships. If you understand your legislative process, you can build the right relationships. I hear people call us all the time, send us emails, and they're operating on a scatter gun. They're sending letters everywhere to everybody, to entities that don't have any control. They're sending them to D.C., and they're sending them to all lawmakers in the state. And I have to tell you that that's really not very helpful to your cause, because you've got to focus like a laser, and you've got to target who can help you. Committee chairs, as I've said, and then on this last bullet point on this slide is committee analyst. And what is an analyst? Well, legislation, even in a part-time legislature, does get some analysis, and I'm going to tell you the types of analysis that I'm familiar with that happens in small states. In our state, we have the committees themselves have a few analysts assigned to each committee, and then the legislature itself has fiscal analysis, and we're going to actually take a look at one during this presentation of what that looks like. And I've visited other websites in the country. I've helped in Nebraska. I've helped in Maryland, and they do a similar thing in terms of the fiscal analysis. I'm not as clear about their committee analysis, but the way it works here is the majority party, the committee analyst work for the majority for the committee, but then the minority party has its own analyst, but they're not assigned to the committee. It's just the party has the minority party. So in our state, the Democrats control the Senate, the Republicans control the House. So every committee in the House is under Republican administration. So the analysts on those committees are employees that are working for the Republican Party. And so when I'm trying to affect the analysis in the House, I have to contact the minority analysts. If the Democrats control the majority of the seats in the state Senate, so all the committee analysts are working for Democratic committee chairs in the Senate. But you've got to figure out who those people are, because they're actually working in a cubicle somewhere with a stack of bills, and they can't be experts in everything, and they're actually looking for information to put in their analysis. But they're not looking for crap. They're looking for good stuff to put in there. It sounds like it's balanced, objective, and that it's something that would be worthy of putting in there. An emotional thing won't do you any good, but they are actually looking for stuff to put in. And I'm going to try to make the switch to a fiscal impact report here. I don't actually have a committee analyst report, but in terms of letting you see how you can actually get into the analytical process. So you told me to hit escape, right?
I did. While you're hitting escape, what I can add is just a little comparison. In Maryland, each of our committees in both chambers, regardless of who, whether it's Republican or Democrat, the committees each have at least one and sometimes two or three analysts that are there on staff, and ours will divide up the general topics. You know, they kind of take on a particular batch of topics for the season, and will as Larry was saying, they'll basically look at all the bills, and you know, try to figure out, well, what are some questions that you know, what are some problems that might be there? What are some positive or negative outcomes that might come from that? You know, they're doing some what-ifs and analysis. We've definitely found it very helpful to figure out who's doing what in each of our two committees to say, okay, you know, this is a bill we're introducing, or these are some bills we're concerned about, and we wanted to make sure you knew about these concerns as you're doing your analysis of the bills. And they'll pull out the bills and look at them with you, and then hopefully, you know, ideally would go back to their committee chairs and other members of the committee with that information. So just wanted to insert that as a comparison of between that one and the New Mexico that Larry was describing. I see you got it up, Larry. So
okay, now this is a fiscal impact report, which is not the same thing as a committee analysis, but this
right.
is where our legislature itself, they have a legislative finance committee. They look at legislation that clearly is going to have, or at least possibly have, an impact fiscally. And this is where I've extended our tentacles into the process of LFC's analysis. And we're not going to read through this because it would take all night, but I'm going to scroll down to these are the sources of information. So these are this was a proposal to expand New Mexico's sex offender registration, House Bill 446 in the 2013 session. And these are all the agencies that weighed in on that legislation. You see the responses received from, and it lists, and you see down at the very bottom, reform sex offender laws. we submitted our position about what we thought of that piece of legislation. We didn't put anything emotional in there, and we're just going to go all the way down to the end, and I'll read what we did say about it, which was a very short. We said a whole lot more, but this is what made it into the report of all the different agencies that respond. Reform sex offender laws, a citizens group composed of sex offender family members and other citizens concerned about SORNA's comments on the addition of the new offenses requiring registration. It suggests, along with other alternatives, that the provision that makes the changes to registration requirements applicable to all sex offenders regardless of their conviction dates be removed, because they were going to change the registration periods for everybody who was already in the system, whether they were in 10 years, they're going to increase. So we said no, we would grandfather those, and that the duty to arising from the new offenses they're putting on the list only be applied prospectively. We got that into the state analysis from the LFC, and that became a debatable point when this legislation was being debated. The legislation ultimately died, but we inserted our viewpoint in an objective fashion, and we let them know that there were problems with that. But all the agencies that felt they would be impacted by this bill weighed in, and this is an anticipated fiscal impact report that Maryland does this, mm-hmm. Nebraska does this, and every state legislature I've clicked on has some similar process and I could tell you that. Even though they do it, I won't waste a lot of time, but it's very skewed because most of the costs for registration are borne by local government, so it doesn't get it. This is what impact it's going to have to the state's general fund budget, and they said minimal because all the cost is hidden. The local sheriffs actually do that, this stuff. So now I need to get back to advancing advocacy, and we hit...
From the current slide.
The current slide. Mm-hmm. Okay. That wasn't as painful as I thought it would be.
There you go. Hey.
So the committees that are in your legislature, you'll have a dozen of them or more. They focus on particular types of legislation. So, in terms of our issue, it's going to be mostly it's going to be your judiciary committees, but there are other committees. If you look at your state website, you'll see there are a lot of standing committees, and. In our state, I can't give an exact count, but I know that it's more than a dozen. And the committee process is to make it possible for legislation to be vetted thoroughly without slowing the entire legislature to a halt. If the entire body tried to debate each bill, and you've got 800 bills introduced in the House and 800 bills in the Senate, and you've got 60 days, you can kind of see how that would work, which would be you wouldn't get to very much. So they channel these through committees that have more expertise, and they break off into hearings, and they hear these bills in public and take comment. The public comment process is sometimes more formal. You have to sign up. You have very, very structured limits. Sometimes it's more open like ours where you just show up, raise your hand, and they take comment. I've been to Nebraska and Maryland in the last few years, and there's a sign-up process, and they're very limited and formal. Our state's a lot less formal, but there is a process in all states, and I think that's an important thing for you need to know is how to get before your committees that are hearing the bills and get your comments in. In addition to verbal comments, it's always good to have something written. And when you're going to provide written documentation, Maryland refers to it as testimony. We refer to it just handouts. But you need to check with the committee chair, or not the chair, but the secretary, the committee staff, and find out how many is required for that committee, because every member needs one. There's some extras needed for staff. So when you show up, you need a certain number of handouts for each committee, and there's deadlines to have them in before the hearing. And all that kind of stuff is part of what you need to know. If you show up without knowing that, your handout is not going to make it in front of your lawmaker. And did you want to add anything about that? Because I know you've learned it very well in Maryland about how to get your handouts.
Definitely.
Your testimony.
Yeah, we were fortunate to have Larry doing some helping us during the first year. We have particular rules. I know we have to, in each committee has a certain number, as he said. We have to have the written testimony in. I think it's about, maybe 45 minutes prior to the start of the session, because they collate them all and hand them all out in a packet beforehand. And you have to have signed up also a certain period of time beforehand if you're going to speak. So those are all things that you have to know. I mean, if you come walking in the door late and you say, oh, but I couldn't find a place to park, well, that's too bad. I mean, they've just got rules to follow. So, what we did was to call, and we got to know the nice men and women that sit in the offices of the committee. In ours, we have committee staff. So I was able to call committee staff and say, can you tell me how many copies we need? And then the other thing would be, for instance, be sure you've put the bill number on the front of anything you're printing. Don't put it in binders. I mean, there's and sometimes different committees may have different rules about that. So, so it's worth giving that committee a call and finding that out ahead of time so you've got that information handy.
So, I'm going to reiterate again that your part-time legislators are reasonably accessible. Of course, the larger the state, they're going to be less accessible because their districts cover a lot more people. Mm-hmm. But in the small states, and I speak of anything less than 10 million people to be reasonably small, you will find that your lawmaker is amazingly accessible. Get to know your representative. Get to know your senator. Attend candidate forums and ask questions. Figure out what their political ideology is, how they believe about crime and rehabilitation. Oftentimes we'll find out we're voting for the wrong people. The people we're voting for are actually a part of the problem. And one way to assure yourself of access is to donate to a candidate's campaign. It takes a lot of money in this modern era to run campaigns, and in our state, they don't receive a salary. In California, they receive about $100,000 a year salary for serving. In our state, they get $150 a day for the 60 days they're in session. So, and that covers their hotel room in Santa Fe. So donate funds to their campaign, and get to know them, and remember, they're just like you. They have spouses and children and friends and enemies. They have joys and fears, and they're very smart in some areas and are totally ignorant in others. They cover so many things in a state legislature, so many topics that they're covering. If any of you, I'm going to try to conserve time and not spend, I had a list of all the different things they cover, but I don't think we're going to spend the time to go to it. But there's so many things that your state government does that they're involved with. They don't just deal with criminal laws. They deal with roads and prisons, and they deal with Medicaid. They deal with schools. They deal with higher education. They deal with environmental regulation. They deal with utility regulation. They deal with workers' comp. They deal with, it goes on and on and on that they deal with. And so they can't be an expert in everything. And when they look at what they're going to become an expert in, they focus on it. Most lawmakers are an expert in a few things. And other things, they rely on the committee analysis. They rely on other people to recommend that they trust. And you can become one of those people if you put the work into it. And they live in the communities they represent, which gives you access. They don't live off someplace else. They live in your district. That they represent you, and they live there. So you have power on this slide. This is something that Brenda stresses, that they need to know that the laws that they passed, how they're affecting their constituents. And most of them, honestly, although registration is painfully obvious to all of us, they don't really know. And the people out there sitting turning up their nose and rolling their eyes right now, how could they not know? If you don't know someone's on the registry, what you know is that nice, good-looking guys with buzz-cut hair with really clean, crisp uniforms have come in and told you that this keeps children safe, and that's what the other states are doing, and that it complies with federal law, and that we need to do this, and the victims' advocates have come in and said we need to do this. And they, when they're taking testimony, they don't hear anybody. We're not there, by and large. Most of our states have no one there, as Oregon just pointed out earlier when he was talking. I mean, they got energized recently, but most of the time, we're not there. And the people they rely on, the Attorney General, the Chief of Police, the District Attorneys Association, all these people are there, and they're telling them that they need this. And it's very difficult, not knowing the adverse and unintended consequences, to vote no when everybody that you look to for advice is telling you to vote yes.
Yeah.
So they need to.
I want to insert here, if I could, that this really is probably the most important thing to remember, because I know on the last month, and then if you talk to Jennifer and myself, that first year, that first time when we all started showing up, we were all nervous as get out. We didn't know what we were doing, but by golly, we knew that the bills they were trying to introduce were bad. And we got up there and we did our best, and we probably said all kinds of silly things we didn't need to say. But the fact that we were there at all was a huge impact on the people in the legislature. They had no idea anybody had any problems with this legislation. And, there was, and now they know us. But we can still go in there sometimes and blow their socks off by the fact that we're bringing up points that nobody would have ever thought about, because they just had no idea. So, it's, you don't have to be uber polished, but it is important to be there and to speak rationally and clearly. Jennifer showed up entirely on her own the time that she went there. She didn't know anybody else was even there. We came in with a number of people the first year we were there, and came back in succeeding years. But it makes so much of an impact, because up until then, all they hear is the victim advocates. All they hear is those police. So it really is extremely important to just remember that. And it's a very powerful statement, even if you're not the best speaker in the world. So end of stump speech.
So... And I like this title, Tread Carefully. There's more than one way to look at a problem or look at an issue. And although we know we're right, we may not be as right as we think we are on everything. And so when you go in there, we can't unequivocally say that the registry has never saved anybody. I don't even try to say that. All I say is that it's unconstitutional to punish people after they've done their time and reporting to a police station, being fingerprinted, and having restrictions on where you live or work is something we do to people when they're being punished. So it sure looks a lot like punishment. And in the United States of America, I don't believe we have the right to intrude in people's lives. And I don't get into all that kind of stuff. But people go in and they have all these compelling arguments, but they're also compelling counterarguments. If for every issue, I pride myself in trying to be able to debate both sides, and I sometimes make enemies doing that, because I try to be able to argue multiple sides of an issue. The registry, to me, is one of the most heinous things that we do in the United States. But you can't say it doesn't do any good. You can say statistically it's not all that measurable, but someone might have been saved from the as a result of the registry. I don't really care. I'm not willing to say I'm not willing to flush the Constitution down the street, down the sewer to save a person. And I'll come back on them and say, well, if you're willing to start flushing the Constitution, clearly we could save a whole lot of people. We started trampling on people's gun rights because the United States has the most guns and the most gun violence in any country in the world. So, but I'm not willing to tread on those constitutional rights either. And so, but if you use the argument it saves one, well, that argument would work on saving one person from gun violence. But when you go in there, realize that there are more positions than just yours. So, you make your position and give them your facts. And I'm talking about facts, not emotion, but you give them your facts, if you have any, and then you close out your meeting because they may not commit to you one way or the other, but they were nice enough to give you the time. And you gotta think about the districts that they represent. And now I would like a virtual show of hands on this one. How many people attended the RSLO conference that was held in Albuquerque back in 2013, or was it 12? Anyway, if anybody came to Albuquerque, they know that they did.
Back in 2013.
Yeah, when you attended the RSOL National Conference, it was held in Albuquerque. Press star 6 on your phone. I want to see how many people are on this call, because I want to illustrate a point here.
All right. And Jennifer, you'll have to give me a count. I think you can sort by the people who've pressed star 6, and then after that you clear the queue. So hope you're still with us. I see it.
I don't see any hands yet.
And I'm just scrolling through here, and I'm seeing maybe just a handful of people that were probably
okay,
there.
So there are people here other than you and I. Okay. Mm-hmm. So those of you who did attend the RSOL conference in Albuquerque, we had one of our state senators, Cisco McSorley, spoke at the mm-hmm. at the conference. That's been a feat that has not been replicated before or since, having an elected official from the state speak. And Cisco McSorley was one of the few that could do that speech, because it's important for you to understand the districts they represent. All lawmakers represent a particular district. They're not elected from the entire state. The state's divided up into districts. And some people tend to be more educated than others. Some districts tend to be more liberal than others. And the lawmaker is elected to represent those people. And he or she is going to remain in office by representing, more often than not, the views of that particular constituency. And those of you that heard Cisco McSorley speak, I mean, he had all sorts of applause, and people said, we wish we could import you to our state. But if you imported him to your state, he wouldn't be able to do you any good just because he was there. Because what makes McSorley unique is the district he represents, which is unique constituents. That we don't have many districts like that in the state. We do have other districts that are liberal and open-minded. But his district is, by the University of New Mexico, a very, very liberal bastion of educated people. And he's able, having been in office a long time, to be a little more out there and not fear being tossed out of office. But part of your homework is to understand that a senator or a representative is somewhat constrained by the views of the people they represent. And if Cisco McSorley went down to southern New Mexico, which is a whole lot more conservative, and built him a house and tried to run for office there, he would probably lose so bad that it would be laughable, because those people don't think the way he does. And so when you're looking at what a lawmaker can do for you, what they can say, it depends on who their constituencies are, who they represent. And I know people are sitting there saying, well, they represent all of us. No, well, they do in a way, but they serve a particular district. And we've got a senator, only one Democrat in southern New Mexico, named John Arthur Smith. He's very conservative, if you can believe that, of a Democrat. He has to be, because Deming is very conservative. And if McSorley tried to run in Deming, he couldn't win. And So it's important to try to do some analysis of what type of constituents, what those districts look like, how sophisticated they are. And sometimes the lawmaker may say nice things to you and say, I agree with you. This is heinous. I can't, but that lawmaker won't be able to do anything for you, because if they vote, they feel like they're going to be vilified in the next election, and politics comes into it. And so another thing you can do is look at the election results and look at how much these people are winning their offices by. If they're winning by 60% or more, they have a lot more what we call political capital. If they're winning by 50.3% to 49.7%, they have very little political capital. If they've been in office for a long time, or if they just got elected, all those things are important to know, because you can start to do analysis to figure out how much capital a lawmaker has by the margins they're winning their elections by, and a little bit about what type of district, what type they represent. And for the real beginners here, on the next slide, it's important you take a field trip to your capital just to find your way around. And they may have an official tour, but you need to look around the capital. We did that at the conference here. We took a small group to Santa Fe. I don't think there was anywhere near a bus full, but we did take some people up there, and we took a tour to look around how the process works. But I'm sure there's some tour process in every capital to find out how the building's laid out, where the committees meet, if your lawmakers have individual offices, where they are. And that would be important for you to do. Stop by, say hello if they're in session. Right now there's not a whole lot of legislatures in session because it's summertime. And we're moving more into the part of the Brenda part of the show here, and we're also all coming up on an hour. So I don't know how far we want to go into this, Brenda, or when you want to get to Q&A, but these slides here are more of the stuff that you had in the original PowerPoint from here on forward.
Well, you'll have to click forward for me if you want me to run through it real quick.
Okay. Well,
I could take back control.
Contact. I can flip forward to what you
sure.
You see what's there now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I will just very quickly touch on some of these things. In making contact with your legislators, the first step is some best practices. The best way to get your message across is to actually meet with them one-on-one. If it's during your legislative session, you're better off visiting the office or calling or faxing, and only then mailing. So always better to meet in person or to call on the phone. All of those ensure at least that you're connecting with their staff. Email for most legislators is still not the best process. Okay, Larry. When you speak to your legislator, by whatever means, always make sure you have a very clear ask. That means a clear action item. It could be vote yes on the bill, vote no on the bill. If you don't have a particular bill, keep the collateral damage we discussed in mind. Would you consider sponsoring a new law and describing the law? Make sure you have something particular you want them to do. If all you do is show up and give them information, you're missing a golden opportunity, because they've given you their time, and that gives you the opportunity to say something. I think Larry touched a little on this earlier, actually. A good advocate, when you show up, you should present yourself well, dress for success, so to speak. You know, don't show up in your jeans and a T-shirt with holes in it. Dress business style, and keep the tattoos and the piercings to a minimum. Make your point clearly and succinctly, and again, understand that there are other viewpoints besides yours. Even if you don't know what they are, just assume they're there and be respectful. I think I touched on the dress for success, business-like, like what you'd wear to an interview. When you show up, and this would be just as true if you're putting it in the body of a letter, state your name, where you're from, This could be your town or your county, exactly why you're there, for instance, to support or oppose a bill or discuss some particular concern you have, and the action item. Say it right up front. This is why I'm here. When you get there, don't waste your time. Don't expect, in fact, I say plan on no more than 10 minutes on the slide here, but in reality, you might have 3 to 5, especially if you're talking with the lawmaker themselves. So don't go in there expecting to tell your life story. You need to have a bulleted list, probably just one page of the key points that you want to make. If you have other stuff to hand them, that's fine. But what you've got to say needs to be really short and really to the point. This is especially during legislative sessions, of course. If you're talking with them other times during the year, you may have a little more time. And always, again, be polite, be professional, no matter what you get back from them. Even if they're rude to you, you got to be nice to them. I touched again, as Larry did here, on the big picture. The legislators do need to balance the wishes of everybody that they hear, and they do need to hear from you, and that's important. But they are looking at the whole picture. So it is important for you to point out when you show up that you are representative of many other people in the state. Not necessarily that you are, you know, the head honcho of some organization, but just literally, there are lots of people in the state just like me or my family or my friends that are adversely affected by the law or will be adversely affected by the law. So that's an important thing to point out to them. You're not just some lone weirdo that's showing up there to talk to them. Okay, Larry. Another point that I always like to mention to my folks here in Maryland, the slide says, do I have to answer that? People will ask personal questions. It's human nature, I guess. But they're a distraction. I'd say 9 or 9.5 times out of 10, it's a distraction from the actual issue. You're there to talk about a bill. You're there to talk about proposed legislation or something that you want to have killed. If you go even a little bit down that road, you have gotten off that track. So you need to be prepared that they're going to say, well, how did you get involved in this issue if you're a female? What was your crime if you're a male? Because they're going to assume you had one. And in each instance, you need to say, well, with all due respect, that's not the concern right now. The concern is, and be able to turn it back around, and you can probably do it more skillfully than that, but that's always a fallback. You know, my concern right now is that you're proposing a 1,000-foot residency restriction, and I'm trying to explain to you why this is bad public policy, and just get right back on it. Focus on the issues. You really don't want to go down the road also because there is almost no such thing as a sympathetic case. You may think you've got one, but it really isn't. So, okay, Larry. And, of course, the other thing is, you know, we talked in the beginning that it's important to be, you know, that you could be the expert here. You know, you are providing a service to your legislator and giving them information they otherwise might not know. But don't be intimidated by the fact that you may get there and they may ask you something that you just don't know. You know, you're too new at it, or they're asking some legal technicality and you don't know that. It's much better to say, I don't know, and I will get back with you. And then at that point, be sure that you do jot down the name of that legislator and what their question is and try to get back to them. Try to look it up and get back to them. Some things that finally that you want to avoid doing when you are talking with legislators. Do not focus solely on yourself and your hardships. Remember that the lawmaker cannot fix your personal situation. He or she can only propose legislation. They can't commute your sentence for you or fix the fact that you're on the registry. All they can do is change a law. And so that you need to remember that. And don't go in talking about the failed justice system. Again, those kind of things are distracting from what they can do. Again, they're there to talk about laws, not about the legal system. So a few extra things that you can have handy to bring with you when you're talking. Your state organization has some flyers, you might have that handy. RSOL has a few general ones that you might have available. If you have some talking points, as I mentioned, your bullet points, make sure you get a nice clean copy of that to leave with them, and make sure that you have given them your contact info. And always remember to say thank you, regardless of the outcome. Even if, again, if they were rude, you clearly didn't change their mind, you still shake their hands, you say thank you for your time. I think we can probably skip.
The end.
Yeah, well, the calls and letters, there's a little more after that, but we can skip. I think we can stop at this point. I think I raced right on through that, didn't I?
You did. Fantastic.
Pretty dang good. I must have done that presentation before at some point. So.
I mean, we're going to go to Q&A, but I would tell people that you're not going to leave this phone call tonight being an effective advocate if you're just now beginning. But hopefully, you're going to leave this phone call with the desire to find out some information and learn some things and begin the process of learning. As Brenda said in 2010 when she got started. I guess we call them a guppy. I think she knew that the Capitol was in Annapolis, but not much more than that. Today, you know, she's one of our more seasoned, believe it or not,
sometimes that's a little scary to contemplate.
I started some 25 years ago. It didn't have anything to do with registration. It had to do with actually my first battle was fighting bringing lottery and gambling to New Mexico. And then I've worked on a number of issues related to social justice and assistance for disabled and housing and a number of things. And some of my relationships go back prior to this issue. But these people that serve in the legislature in an elective office, they serve for two reasons. And either one of them, you have to understand, they want to advance their own personal careers, one. That's the most cynical one of all. And they want to rise through various elective offices, and this is a stepping stone. There are a lot of other people who actually want to do good work, and I've met many of them, and I'm proud to say that I've worked with them that really care about having good public policy. And they reach out for information and they try to do the right thing. But regardless if they're in the group one or group two, they can't help you if they lose their office. And politics is a very, very dirty business. We live in a modern era where I got you politics. Everything has changed in terms of how campaigns are run. Information is they're tweeting and they're doing social things. When I started back in the 80s, I mean, it was you hardly ever saw anybody show up at the Capitol other than lobbyists, and there were a lot fewer of them. Citizens seldom showed up, and business was done mostly behind closed doors, and politics was a lot friendlier. But in this day and age, one vote, even a good vote, can really destroy a person's political career. And not many people are willing to sacrifice their political career for sex offenders. So let's be honest about that. There's not many people who, if they're trying to do good, they don't want to give up the opportunity to do good to try to help sex offenders. And if they're trying to advance their political career, very few people see this as an opportunity to gain votes in terms of being soft on sex offenders. They actually can gain votes on the other side, but in terms of trying to reform, to do the things we're looking for. So when the legislature is looking at stuff, you got a whole lot of people who have different viewpoints, and they have different agendas, and you have to figure that out, where they're coming from. And once you figure out where they're coming from and what whether they're looking for higher office and what they're in this arena for, you can be a lot more successful. And that takes hanging out at the Capitol, getting to know these people. And you'll spend a lot of time in your Capitol if you really want to master this. It's not something you can do from behind a keyboard. But I know we're running out of time, so we want to get to some Q&A. So, let's fire that part of the session up.
Yep, that would be good. So, again, if you have a question for Larry or for me, you press star 6, and we will take you in the order that you arrive. And I cannot see the queue, so... shall I take that screen back from you, Larry?
You can take it back, yes.
Okay. Take it back. I don't know if you are seeing my screen.
I've got one, Brenda. I unmuted myself. So here's our first one.
All righty. So just speak up and...
I presume that's maybe me, Brenda.
That's you.
Actually, I wanted to not so much ask a question as to thank you both for a really great presentation. And for somebody who's been working with this stuff for about 6 years now, I think you're spot on with what you're saying. I would sort of sum up what I think is most important about what you said is four things. It's knowing the process, relationships, and relationships. That's really what, and you've said that in so many ways, and I thought I might just mention a couple of examples that we've had lately. One was that we had a bill come up in our legislature this spring, and it was awkward because it was sponsored by the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who's been very supportive of us. And it was a bill that would require, it was actually, this is to underscore one more thing that you didn't mention when you said where bills come from. In our state, an awful lot of bills come from the press who create pressure to create them. And this was created exactly by that. Portland Television showed up on the chair's front lawn with cameras and demanded that they know what he was going to do about homeless sex offenders in Portland. And so he drafted a bill that required all homeless sex offenders to register every 3 weeks. And we didn't know how to tackle that. And I wrote a letter to the chair and to the committee, I know all those people now. But after doing that, I called the person who's in charge of probation and parole in our county, who I've also worked with. And Jeff's a great guy, and we see a lot the same way, even though he works for the sheriff's department. And I said, what do you guys think about this? And he said, well, I don't like it. And I said, what is your boss? What does your sheriff think? And he said, I don't know. I should talk to him. But I don't think he'll like it. And this comes up to that issue of cost. I don't think we've got enough funds to handle this kind of thing. And this was on a Friday. On Monday afternoon, the bill was pulled, and it was because that guy and his boss, the sheriff, visited the chair of the committee, who said a couple of days later, I pulled the bill because I was operating on bad information.
Right.
And it helps enormously not just to know people in the legislature and also what the pressures on them are, but sheriff's departments have a lot of weight, and they can make arguments we can't make. It's having allies. We worked closely from the beginning, and I learned most of what you guys talked about from a mentor who is the lobbyist for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Mm-hmm.
But the more people you know, the more points of view you have in mind, the more you can do all the things that you're talking about. And I'll shut up now, but I thank you for the conversation.
But thanks a lot, Ken. That was a really good example of again, of the importance of relationships and how they connect.
They're great, great points about relationships. We try to build all we can with other entities.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else in the queue?
I don't think so, Brenda.
Ah, come on, people. Star 6, got any questions?
They all went to sleep.
They all went to sleep? Well, no.
They all went to sleep. Or maybe there's no one on the line.
Oh, no, there's somebody.
Here's somebody.
Hey, this is Don from South Carolina.
Hi.
I have an observation, or a couple of them, actually. One is to just grab hold of one of the issues that you brought up in the presentation, and that is to make sure that you're making people aware that you're representing a lot of other people, because one of the things I've run into is that my local legislators don't have anything whatsoever to do with the Judiciary Committee that handles all the sex offender-related bills.
Right.
And several times in trying to contact other lawmakers, when they found out I wasn't in their district, they hung up the phone. I mean, almost literally. It was, well, one time it was a staffer, and I was told rather impolitely that he didn't have time to talk to me because I wasn't in his district, period. So you can run into that, and that I really like the idea of making sure people understand that you're representing a lot of people in their district, even though you don't live in their district.
Yeah.
That's the other thing of having an organization behind you. But go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. The other thing was just to relate an experience that I had recently when I talked to a local legislator who happens to be somebody that I've known for several years, and I'd made reference to this in some of the write-ups before, but he showed up as a sponsor for a horrible bill last year, and I was not happy about it. But the funny thing was, he also was showing up as a co-sponsor of a couple of the favorable bills dealing with juvenile offenders. So I was a little kind of wondering where this paradox was coming from, and I called him. And we had quite a good conversation about the whole thing. And it turns out that with regard to the one bill that I particularly didn't like, he honestly didn't even know what was in the bill. He had been talked into signing on as a sponsor as a favor to somebody, and he had not even read the bill and had his name listed as a co-sponsor.
That can happen.
It can happen, and at the national conference, people kind of made allusion to this, that, you know, we give legislators too much credit sometimes for knowing what's in all these bills, and earlier, I think Larry talked about the quantity of stuff that's out there, the number of bills, and that was the reaction I got from this representative, too. He said, Don, there are so many things in front of us and confronting us that I can't possibly read this stuff. He said, usually I'm reading it when it goes on the agenda and I know I'm going to have to vote for it. He said, I may have to read 200 and 300 pages a night before these votes come up. He said, I don't have time to read anything that isn't in the forefront. So he went through this bill on the phone with me. And he took one look at the bill, of which he was a co-sponsor, and he said, this will never even get a hearing.
Well, that's comforting.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. That is definitely...
He recognized how offensive it was and how outrageous it was. He said, this won't even get a committee hearing.
Wow, that's comforting. But I definitely do like... Yeah.
He thought the only reason that the guy had proposed the bill originally was just to make some constituent happy.
That happens quite a lot. Don, can I borrow, because you just reminded me of a slide I was thinking of making and I didn't make it. And that's when you want to have an impact, too many people make the mistake of calling people who cannot help them. And I touched on it, but I should have had a slide. When the bill that you're worried about is House Bill 422, and it's still in the House, and it's still in its committee, and you want to call your state senator, you're wasting your senator's time, because your senator has no interest in House Bill 422. It may never, ever get to the Senate. So you need to target like a laser where you put that energy, and don't call the person who cannot help you. And people do that all the time. You know, and the staffers roll their head when they get a phone call about a Senate bill that's still in the House, or vice versa. So you need to be following where the legislation is, because they look at it when it comes within their range of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I do think that the other point that Don was making that doesn't go back out the other side of my head.
They don't want to talk to somebody outside their district.
Outside the district.
And I was going to address that here too as well.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
That is quite common. On a personal office visit, you might have a better chance of getting to see someone who's not your representative or senator. But the best way to get to see them is that, believe it or not, they don't float from one part of the building to the other. You have to live at your Capitol and learn how they navigate from point A to point B. They've all got picture directories, so they've got, you know, on the websites, and most states publish a directory in the printed form, but you can figure out who they are, and you get to know them. And you're getting to know them will be a brief introduction. Hi, I'm Don, and I'm interested in talking to you about issue A, and make sure it's an issue with it that they have some control over. It's going to be before the committee that they serve on. And then you might have a better luck. You will have better luck if you form a personal relationship with them. But in terms of getting to see people that are not your representative, it can be difficult because they've got a plethora of constituents that are wanting to talk to them. Mm-hmm. And I work in the senator's office, and we have the same attitude when they call here. First thing I do is ascertain where you live.
Yep.
If you're
yep.
not in the district, you're only going to deal with me if you're not in the district. And I'll actually talk to people who don't live in the district. But the senator seldom talks to people who don't live in the district.
Yeah. And so it is important to get to know who those committee people are. And that was the point I think I was going to add was that if you have a group, even if your group isn't like, if it's RSOL South Carolina, for instance, even though you haven't like fully formed or whatever, but you can, by golly, you can say that I'm Don, you know, and this is my organization, it has more impact. you may be a while off from incorporating or getting a 501c3 or something like that, but if you've got a group, however informal it is, use that group name if the group approves. I do have a rule, for instance, in my state. You know, I encourage my folks to come and testify, but they don't get to testify on behalf of FAIR unless they have cleared that message with me or I've worked with them directly. That's just to make sure that as an organization we have a clear message. But it's still very valuable to be able to say in some way or another, you know, that I am speaking on behalf of other registered citizens in your district about this House bill that you sponsored or that is in your committee. And you may only get a staffer, but, you know, and a staffer is fine because if you've got a staffer in your state, mine all have at least one staff person in their offices. So there's usually somebody you can talk to, and that's okay. But that then they're more likely to hear you. Okay. I think we may have another question or two.
Is that why you were shaking so bad when I was talking without clearing my testimony through you?
No, not at all. So I know we had at least one person that was wanting to get in the queue. Do we have anybody else?
Yes. Hi, good evening. This is Alexis, California.
Hello.
And I'm sorry, I don't know your names. This is my first time on a call, but I've been staying in contact with the emails signed on with, and also passing your information out on Facebook, you know, for other people who will have a place to go.
Great.
And to get informed, to be able to fight this in the way, in the manners that you were speaking of earlier, and to support those who are already on the front line with all this. I'm speaking here because my son had been in prison for 22 years on a sexual offense. Okay, and he just got his parole. He'll be supposed to be paroled in November. Everything was set. And what's come to my attention that he just called me yesterday and is talking about that this agency called the Forensic Services Division out of Sacramento, California, they want to evaluate him now. After parole's cleared him for parole, I spoke to his parole officer, seemed like a decent man. And so that they're considered VHS evaluators, which stands for Sexual Violent Predator. Now, this came up all of a sudden. They're trying to get him to interview with them and to evaluate him and to sign on the dotted line, not with just one, but several other, I don't know if they're a real doctor, a psychologist, psychiatrist. I don't know what their credentials truly are. But they said the worst case scenario to him, and this is how they told him, if the worst that can happen here, if we deem you, and they all vote, not to be able to come out on parole, then you will be taken to Coalinga Mental Hospital, yeah. And you may leave in a box. Worst case scenario.
Right. I'm going to interrupt you because, you know, this isn't about lobbying, but it's an important question. I may be able to hook you up with somebody there that can help you in that
yes.
process. Do you have my email address? I don't mind giving that out, but I don't want to get yours captured on the recording. If you'll send me a message to B. Jones, that's B as in Brenda, Jones, at nationalrsol.org. And just shoot me an email after this is over, and I'll try to hook you up with somebody there in California that can help you a little bit with that situation.
Certainly appreciate it because I have kept you guys in mind, so when he did come out, I wanted him to join you because he's got a good legal mind. He's very intelligent.
Sure.
And being in this, I know there's a lot of people's children suffering from their parent being caught up in as a sex offender. And now it's affecting young boys and girls as well. And
certainly.
Yeah, and that's my concern. I have a lot of great-grandchildren and children and friends. It's just too big to not do something about this category and to do it in a lawful way, the way you were speaking of so eloquently and strategically
sure.
to legislate, you know? And I want to I'm in it for the long haul myself.
Right. All right. Very good. Okay, so you got my email. Shoot me an email when it's done, and I'll get you hooked up with somebody.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for there.
Sure. Okay. And next question, please.
Hi, my name is Andy Stein, and I'm in Georgia. Larry, I guess I'll be meeting you Friday up in at the hotel there by the airport.
Looking forward to that.
Me too. And I'll just put out that I know nothing about what's going on as far as these processes and procedures, so I'm very green and new, which I guess is really mostly what my question is. Are there maybe like low-hanging fruit? Are there templates of laws that we are trying to fight against? Or, I mean, is there any sort of cookie cutter that we can kind of ride off of each other since we're sort of all dealing with the same thing, just different variations of it?
I'll let you tackle that one, Larry.
Well, thank you. Not really. Each state statutory scheme is so different that you have to start with existing law when you're amending law. So you have to look at what you have, and you start with that language. So to amend the law, you start with existing law, and you type in overstrike if you want to eliminate a paragraph or a certain part of a paragraph or a sentence, and then you insert the new sections. And so the problems are different, varying from state to state. The southern states tend to have more problems than the rest of the country because they're more punitive driven. But in Alabama, Mississippi, the big issue is that they have sex offender on their license and they have to get a permit to travel even when they're not on supervision, and they have to send out notices at their expense. So it would depend on the low-hanging fruit varies from state to state, because what might be achievable in Vermont, in a much more liberal state where the restrictions are fairly lenient, they would laugh at you because they said, well, we don't have to deal with any of that in Vermont. I mean, in Vermont, they mail in a form once a year.
That's true.
It's very state-specific in terms of what would need to be done. And so there's not a lot of cookie cuttering that can be done. Sorry about that.
Sure. One issue that I'm really confused about is I have a 7 to 7 curfew, and I just, for the life of me, I've been out for 18 months and I can't figure out why I have a curfew. And everybody that's on probation in my particular county has a curfew.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can,
and I would presumably have it for like 12 more years. I would have this. I would have to be in by 7 o'clock at night. I am flabbergasted that would be the case.
Well, and it very well could end up being the case for the entire supervision. For you. And we'll talk more about that when we're together on Friday. Mm-hmm. Where do you live in Georgia?
I'm in Houston County. I'm about 90 minutes south of where that hotel is.
I know where Houston County is. And for all you people in Texas, they spell that the same way, but they just don't,
just don't
pronounce it that way in Georgia.
Yes, exactly. It's Houston, Georgia, but
that's
funny.
All
in Austin. Yeah, very strange.
We should have a Texan or two on here tonight. Yes, they pronounce Houston in Georgia.
Well. All righty.
So I'm looking forward to talking to you, Andy, and I appreciate your willingness to drive that far to the meeting.
I would drive further, but yes, I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you there.
Great. Great. I will say, I think apropos of that question, while there aren't, there's not cookie cutters per se, but I do think most of us end up getting our start with this as basically fighting bad bills, maybe because there's just more of them out there. But there's the first step is to go learn how to find the bills, by going onto your state legislature site, finding your way around. Because usually the first thing that happens is, oh my gosh, they're about to pass residency restrictions, or they're looking to do the Adam Walsh Act, or whatever it is, or they're about to add more stuff to the driver's license, whatever it is. If anything, that's probably the low-hanging fruit, because you can have more impact going there and just saying, hey, this is going to affect a whole bunch of people, and it's unconstitutional, or it's expensive, or whatever it is. And that, again, is state-specific, but it's a that's the place to start usually. So I just wanted to toss that out there. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we had one more question. I believe, unless Jennifer's added more since then. So,
we got
hello.
A lady name.
Yep.
Okay.
This is Dave Brown. Out here
Hi,
in
Salem,
Oregon.
You made it back.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, thanks. Ken Noli, and his wife I'm glad he's on the line tonight. They've really been doing a bang up job here in Oregon. Just to see how this can really hit home. I got off probation in 2003, I think, and then we moved to a house. Well, I went through the whole thing of not being able to live within three blocks of a park or of a school. We had bought a house that fit that, but then after we were off, we bought one that was close to a school because I didn't have any restrictions. And then all of a sudden, God, if this had come in, I'd have had to move. And they are... They're doing a really good job out here. I got off the registry in July, and not as easy to do in Oregon. Some states you just automatically drop off if you have a lower level crime. But mine, I had to go to a judge and pay $3,000 to a lawyer to petition. But Ken and Janet are just doing really a good job. And I've met with them three times with the group the Oregon Voices. I've just attended the meetings, and they're just really some of the nicest people you ever want to meet. So anyway, thumbs up for you, Ken. I know you can't really respond, but I'll see you again. All right, I'll get off now. Have a good
Thanks,
day.
David. All right, so that just does show that a lot of people, again, are impacted by our actions when we try to step out and block bad legislation. Is there anybody else, Jennifer, or is our queue cleared at this point?
This is Ken again, and it's kind of awkward to come on after David. He's very nice. And, I just wanted to add one thing to something that Don was saying about South Carolina and about dealing with people who aren't your legislator. In addition to what you guys have said about figuring out how to track bills and see what ones have been proposed and seeing when they're coming up to committees and so on, the other thing that I don't think got mentioned is we found it really useful to read up on members of committees. What have they voted for in the past? How have they voted for sex offender bills? And what we learn, of course, is what all of us have done this for a while learn, is this isn't necessarily a Republican-Democrat position. And we have depended heavily in Oregon on the leadership from a couple of conservative Republican former policemen who believe in redemption and that people can change and are in safe conservative districts and can argue for these things as public safety matters. So it's not going to the people who, just the people who you think are safe and can support this in one way. That exists on both sides of the aisle and sometimes in surprising ways. And you can learn something about that by looking at their voting records. And on that front, I guess I would also say, I do think, though you want to be careful when they ask you about your story, that good stories do matter. And we're really convinced that we come in with really carefully reasoned arguments and lots of data, but we got to have compelling stories too.
You are absolutely right.
Stories that reach across the aisle.
Yeah, you are absolutely right, and I hope I didn't give the impression you should never tell a story. If the story is illustrative of the point that's trying to be made, you know, absolutely, because you're humanizing that. And I do sometimes suggest to people, especially if they're going kind of at down times or they're talking to their legislators outside of the, you know, during a legislative session, that, you know, you could go in there and share a bit of a story. And your ask, as I mentioned, your ask at that point would be, remember me and my family the next time you get a, you know, one of these punitive laws. You know, so that's,
nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And you're absolutely right about the, researching the committee members and their voting records. I haven't always had much luck with the voting records because here they're all too scared. They all vote for anything, even if you talk to them behind closed doors. So what I usually tell people to do is just see which ones are not talking. You know, they're not out there, or they have abstained. But if one of them makes it to the floor and has to be voted on, they're all going to vote for it. They're all too scared not to, even if they don't like it. So we haven't had much luck with the vote, but you can definitely look at, you know, the other committees they've served on and what their interests are, and all of that stuff is available online. So it's a good help.
The other thing we've learned is that a lot of stuff happens in our legislature about sex offenders on the last day of the session. And if it can get through one house, it gets to the other house, and it's been typically the Senate, which is harder for us. The House gets it through, goes to the Senate, and then, while it's hard for us to see this, there's horse trading going on, and people are saying, well, if you'll support, I would like to support this, but I can't. You support it, and I'll vote for your bill here. And we're getting bills through, just squeaking through on the last day of the session.
Last hour.
Even in the last hour. But people aren't going to see that, you know, in the news isn't going to cover that so much.
Mm-hmm.
And signed by the governor 2 months later, and those are bills that our legislature figures out a way to get those things very quietly. And that's one of the ways. I like what you said about silence. There's a good deal of silence in helping our bills go through.
There is. Larry, do you have anything you want to add to that? Because, I think he's hit some nails on the head from what I know.
He's made some good points in terms of the last days. That's common in part-time legislature. Matter of fact, when I used to live in Georgia decades ago, as they were winding down towards midnight on the adjournment, they would old Speaker Tom Murphy would stop the clock at 10 till midnight. And he was the official timekeeper, and the clock would be stopped, and they would pass the bills that had to be passed, and he would say, "Now it's 12 o'clock, and we're going to adjourn." But that happens in part-time legislature. Stuff moves very, very, very fast in the final few days, and deals are made, and that's just the way it has to be. One of the things that really irritates me is people say, well, they made a political decision. Well, folks, we live in a political system. We'll elect people to represent us. I mean, what are you wanting, a monarchical decision? The process is political. That's what we live and die by in America. So deals are made, and that's just the way the sausage is made. Unfortunately, sometimes it cuts against us. But if we can kill these bills before they get out of committee, unless you have a really screwy process where things that are dead in committee get resurrected in the middle of the night, if you can stop them from moving away through the committee, a bill can't be voted in the floor of most unicameral, I mean, most of the legislature that operate under Mason's rules unless it's been cleared by committee and it's been properly brought to the floor. So that's where the battle is in your committees. And
agreed.
I would agree with you what you said about it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. But those people that you're talking about, if you check their margins of victory, I just about bet you'll find they have political capital. Those people who are willing to talk about redemption, they're not winning by 50.3 to 49.7. they're winning by huge margins, which gives them political capital to work with.
Exactly.
So, that's the key to what a lawmaker can do for you. If they've got capital and they're inclined, they can help you, whether they're conservative or liberal. If they don't have no capital, if they're not positioned in the right part of the legislature, they can't help you. Capital and being in the right place is how a lawmaker can help you.
Absolutely.
Thanks to you both for.
Thanks.
We've got one more.
All righty. Last one. Okay. No more questions, please.
Hello. My name is Don Johnston. And I have a question or maybe even a statement about lobbying and bills. Is that I'm with Titus House Ministries, which is up in Tijeras, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we are a prison ministry that we send out monthly newsletters to over 15 states. And we also sent out mentoring sheets and collect phone calls, and once they get out, we help them out with clothing, the watch, bus pass, and other needs that they might need if it's a bike. We deal with sex offenders. And what I was going through the website, because a lot of these people were looking for housing and jobs. And I would be able to find out where other sex offenders, reformed sex offenders, were living, and also where they were working. And then it came to me that the listing of these businesses were a problem because, you know, people could call these business people, and they would. You know, could harass them, you know, say, hey, do you know you have a sex offender living there? And then when I was at the Dallas convention, I heard Mary Sue from Texas mention that she was able to present a bill to be able to get the housing removed from the website. So therefore, I started thinking, you know, it might, you know, not only did it help us to get the listing for, you know, people where they're working, but also, you know, I started thinking, you know, maybe I could do something in a similar way to present a bill to be able to get this removed from our website. I contacted Mary Sue, and she sent me some talking points and her bill and whatnot. And then I started talking to Larry Neely, and one of the first things that he told me to do is that I needed to get support from the business association. You know, if I could get support from them saying that, hey, you know, we believe in a second chance for you know, prisoners or you know, reformed sex offenders, or returning citizens. That you know, if I could get support from them, then that would be a good way to approach these legislators. You know, and you know, Larry also said, you know, you would. If I could do this, you know, that there was a possibility that, you know, he would help me with a bill to present it. And, you know, right now I'm trying to follow up on the – I sent a letter to the Businessmen Association. I talked to them on the phone, but they wanted to get it in writing. So, you know, I just, you know, agree with the need to get other people, you know, behind you on a cause. You know, like this, and you know, that's. I just wanted to thank Larry, you know, for his help. You know, I know he helps a lot of different states and whatnot. And you know, this is an important issue for us, you know, as a ministry, to help these returning citizens. You know, and that's what I wanted to say.
All right. Well, thanks, Don, very much. And that is a good point that you know, bringing in members of the community is a very useful. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thank Larry for suggesting that I would do that. Yeah.
Mhm. Mhm.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Don. We got a tough road to hoe on that particular legislation in this state because our governor is a former prosecutor and. And we had a previous piece of legislation that would have just removed the language that says right now our website only has the sex offender if they work directly with children, and we tried to change it to unsupervised contact with children, and the governor vetoed that language where it was just a slight change and said that she would do nothing that lessened access to this information. So what we know is that I take her at her word that she would veto anything that would lessen restrictions of sex offenders, so therefore we're going to have a huge support from people that she respects, which would one place would be the business community to get that information off the Internet. But it would be a great thing for both the sex offenders and the businesses because they do get harassed for employing, and some of them just choose not to.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Well, thanks very much, Don, for sharing that, and Larry for being on the call. We're going on an hour and 45 minutes now, so I think it's time to turn off the recording. And thank you all very much for.